Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello, I'm Matt Chorley, and this is Politics Without the Boring Bits. Don't worry, your Easter is okay. Rishi Sunak says the election won't be on May the 2nd. Other Tories are saying they think a feel-good summer of sporting success, some nice weather, might boost the Tories in the polls. Today, we look at whether there really is such a thing as a feel-good factor and what impact it has on politics and the pulse. Really great chat coming up on that. We'll also be joined by the columnists Miranda Green and James Marriott, taking a look at whether James is right to be enjoying his short-haul flights. We'll also take a look at what we learned this week. And don't forget, if you like what you hear on the podcast, you can join me for Politics Without the Boring Bits live on Times Radio, on your DAB radio, on your smart speaker, or download the Times Radio app. That's Politics Without the Boring Bits, weekdays from 10. But first, as we always do here on the podcast, let's take a look at what we learned this week. We learn that Boris Johnson will be back campaigning for the Tories to the delight of his old friend Lord Marland.
Conservatives want to win the next election, so you should use every quiver in your sheath.
Well, Boris Johnson's no stranger to having a few quivers in his sheath. We also learn that Boris Johnson has been on a secret trip to Venezuela. It must be a totally different Boris Johnson, who repeatedly criticised Jeremy Corbyn with the same lame joke.
I say he's crackers.
Talking of crackers, we learned that Lee Anderson was joining Reform UK.
Reform UK has offered me the chance to speak out in Parliament on behalf of millions of people up and down the country.
Which must be a completely different Lee Anderson to the one who said...
Reform is not the answer.
So you don't think that Richard Tice has got the minerals to be a proper politician?
I think he's a pound shop. Nigel Farage.
We learned how Keir Starmer reacted to Peter Manson telling him to lose weight.
He sent me a sort of droll text message on the day. Yes. He's completely unaffected by it. Honestly, he doesn't have a shred of personal vanity in him.
Well, look, again, I couldn't care less.
We learned a new piece of political wisdom from Polly McKenzie.
You can't win an election if you're a bleeding torso.
We learned that former First Sea Lord Alan West had fun when he was one of Gordon Brown's ministers.
I was accused of having an affair with Frieda from ABBA, which is quite exciting.
We learned from Hugo Rifkin that Penguin Love Island has a certain aroma.
Boulder's Beach, Cape Town, you go there the wrong time of year, reeks of penguin love.
We learned that Mariella Frostrop can confirm that.
I've smelt that penguin love.
It's only a matter of time before Boris Johnson goes to Penguin Island there on a secret visit. And that is what we learned this week. Now, it's time for this.
The Columnists.
Yes, it's Friday, but no India night. We have got James Marriott. James, how are you?
I was hunched on my bedroom floor with my laptop, frantically battering away at my column.
Sorry, James. I didn't even know that was going to happen. How are you, James?
Yeah, just to come out with that. I'm slightly tired, actually.
Tired, yeah. Are you?
Looking forward to my
holiday.
You've
read a whole column this week.
Yeah, I know.
You must be exhausted.
You know, it's hard work.
Well, we'll come to your holidays in a moment. We've got Miranda Green, Deputy Opinion Editor at the Financial Times. Hello, Miranda.
Hello. Are you, nice to be here.
How are you? Are you tired?
Well, I went to Liverpool yesterday, so I didn't take my step counter, but I think I probably did about 25,000 steps yesterday, Liverpool and back. I mean, I didn't walk the whole way, you understand, I got a train.
But to be honest, it might be quicker to walk.
I feel intrepid and a bit tired today, yeah.
Everybody just needs a rest. Everyone. We should just take the next half hour off and
just pop some music on. Put some music on, just have a calm down.
Well, at least we don't have to have an election within minutes, though, right?
Oh, what a segue. What a segue, Miranda Picard. Well, let's take a listen then. This was the Prime Minister on ITV West Country last night.
In several weeks' time, we've got elections for police and crime commissioners, for local councils, for mayors across the country. They're important elections.
And not a general election.
That's what I'm focused on. There won't be a general election on that day.
That's it then. We can all pack up. In fact, it's good news because I've been putting off booking a holiday for Easter just in case. Do you think we should believe him?
The same.
Oh, you've been doing the same, right?
Yeah, I didn't know whether to press the button or not. So now I can. So I'm a happy woman this morning.
Do you think there was ever a realistic possibility or was it just something being talked up by Labour?
Well, I think the opposition parties clearly felt they had to be ready in case the Prime Minister called a spring election. So I think there will be a sort of slight easing off in SW1 today. But, you know, in my view, and I know this is also Danny Finkelstein's view, that the Prime Minister's mad not to go a bit earlier because I think things could get much worse for the government as the months go on. But there we are. You know, we now have all got a marathon, not a sprint, as it were, so we better get fit.
Does this affect your plans, James?
Not at all, no. I holiday without any regard at all to politics because I never have to write about it. It's one of the great freedoms. Maybe if like an exciting new book comes out, then, you know, cancel all my plans. But
if there was a new Harry Potter,
I'd cancel it all.
what do you think he needs to do over the summer, James? If he's decided he's going to go long rather than short, what could he do?
I mean, I don't think there's really anything he can do at this point. I mean, I know everybody kind of disparages this logic that something might turn up, but I sort of understand it. I kind of think, you know, how much worse could it be in terms of polling? And, you know, I think it's less what Rishi Sunak will do and the kind of, you know, one in a million outside, you know, possibility that you'll uncover some, like, you know, video of Keir Starmer doing something terrible or, you know, there'll just be some sort of unexpected political meteorite from the outer galaxy that will mess everything up. And although I think that's not going to happen, I do get the, you know, psychology just hanging on and waiting for an event.
Something.
Yeah.
Either that he does or the... I mean, I suppose there is always the possibility, Miranda, that something engulfs the Labour Party.
Well, there is. And also, just thinking of James's words there, there is a meteorite in the offing, isn't there, in the shape of Donald Trump. So, you know, in a sense, the American election could bleed into the British general election in helpful and unhelpful ways to either side. I mean, it's not hard to imagine Trump sort of calling Starmer a commie or something, you know, and then that would sort of play into our election and disrupt the grid for all the parties. So, you know, I think James is right about that and also absolutely right about the psychology. I mean, Rishi Sunak is not going to get another chance to be prime minister. So he might as well hang on and try and build some sort of legacy.
Yeah.
Also, I think crucially for the Tory party, you know, they do think they can say that the economy is starting to turn the corner. And all the evidence from previous elections here in the UK, but also in the US, is if you've got the seeds of an economic recovery, you need to give it time for people to be able to feel it. So it's no good saying, OK, inflation's coming down if people can still see food prices going up. You have to wait a few months until people actually see the prices coming back down again. And that goes for, you know, all the kind of cost of living crisis elements. So I think on that sort of core economic argument as well, there's an argument for them going long. I hope they don't go long, 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 though. I mean, I think January 2025 would really try the nation's patience, don't you?
That's Boddy McKenzie's prediction from How to Win, is that... I think Peter thought May, they should do May, but actually they did end up doing October.
Was it Polly who said that it would look slightly better, you know, maybe Rishi Sunak's thinking instead of, you know, Rishi Sunak Prime Minister till 2024, he can like make his dates look slightly longer.
That's
a depressing thought.
He would be 2022, 2025.
Yeah, which looks almost substantial.
Really, that looks like a decent shift.
But that's a sort of CV building trick, isn't it? I mean, you know.
Yeah, he's basically thinking of his LinkedIn more than or gravestone. One of the two. Well, maybe he needs to bulk up. Maybe that would help, because there's been a lot of discussion, and it'll wind listeners up no end. Because whenever we have this discussion, people say, "Oh, we should be concentrating on policies." But people, this does matter. Height, weight matters in politics, and it was all brought up last week on How to Win an Election, when Peter Mandelson, we were talking about fashion. That's how we got into this, and that does make a difference to how people vote. And this is what Peter Mandelson said.
My problem with Rishi Sunak's fashion is that he wears these, you know, very fashionable skinny suits and narrow ties, and I think they diminish him rather than expand him. And just to be completely sort of even-handed about it, I think that by the same token, Keir Starmer needs to shed a few pounds, and that would be an improvement.
Now, Miranda, you wrote about this in the FT as well, and you think there is actually something in this.
Well, if you look, for example, at the height of successful candidates to be the American president, they're all way taller. I mean, Abraham Lincoln, can you believe it? 6'4", which in those days he must have towered like a giant. And by and large, the taller candidates tend to win. And also, I think, you know, to Peter Mandelson's discussion there, you can't actually hide from the fact that when people are choosing a national leader, all sorts of parts of human psychology come into play. And I think on a kind of really basic level, you're thinking, okay, well, who can lead our tribe? You know, and you sort of want somebody who looks as if they're up for the fight. And so physical fitness and the appearance of physical fitness, and also a kind of sense of physical presence, which often shows itself through height or heft, as I called it in my piece, actually does play into voters, you know, perceptions of a potential leader. And, you know, you're quite right. I got this a lot in response to my piece as well. You know, how silly, why does this matter? It should be all about the policies. But actually, you know, we are animals, you know, and we still carry around these atavistic feelings and in terms of our reactions to other humans. And so height matters, weight matters, and generally physical fitness matters. But also because, you know, this is a really tough 7-day-a-week job. You have to be in good shape for it. And there are lots of great examples. I mean, somebody got in touch with me after my piece to say that, in fact, Roy Jenkins had agreed on this. And the great Roy Jenkins had said to David Markland, the great political thinker, that physical stamina was the most important thing in politics. And I tell you, having worked for, trailed around after Paddy Ashdown for several years, I mean, you know, you do need to be fit to be in the game, you know, let alone to win it.
And actually, do you know what, the other thing, after having read your piece, and I was sort of thinking about it, one of the things that people always say about William Hague and Ed Miliband is they're much taller than they expected. Because they're both, I don't know how tall they are, I'm terrible at heights. But when you meet them, they are much, and I think the reverse slightly happened, because particularly Ed Miliband, I mean, William Hague was sort of slightly reborn as foreign secretary, but obviously, you know, there was a time when he was the sort of the joke leader of the opposition. That actually, Ed Miliband's poor political performance sort of shrinks him in the mind, and you think he's a sort of a little nerd. And actually, he's quite a tall man.
I think that's really true. There's something also, I don't know if anyone else feels this, I always assume that Boris Johnson must be quite a kind of big, hefty guy, but I think he's actually about my height, which is not big at all, really. There was a brilliant column, and there's so much other stuff that was occurring to me. I think hair is probably, I was trying to think, has a, you know, bald leader of the opposition ever beaten a, you know, someone on the other side who's got more hair than them? Well, I bet that may not be true.
Churchill was the last properly bald prime minister?
Yes, and he kind of came into office initially not by an election.
Yeah.
So maybe he didn't. Clement Attlee, who beat him in 45, was bald, but slightly less bald than Churchill. And this may be nonsense. And I was reminded of, I was reading a study, I think, of congressional elections in America, where they found that you could basically predict who would win by which candidate was more attractive, with like a reasonable degree of accuracy, because people also vote for people with like more even faces.
Yes.
Well, I mean, hooray for radio, right, colleagues? Because the television age has been very cruel to a lot of people with, you know, big brains and a lot to offer. But I'm sure you're right about that, James. On hair, I spoke to Luke Trill of More in Common for the column I wrote, and he said, interestingly, that hair comes up in his focus groups. And he's interested in whether people are making a link when they describe Keir Starmer as grey. What do they really mean? Are they just talking about his hair, or is that also something they feel about his kind of slightly unfocused?
I think he's got great hair.
Platform.
I think he's kind of leader of the Labour Party in no small part to his very like serious looking hair.
Well, it's funny you should say that, because someone's just texted in saying, "Yes, appearance matters. Why won't someone stick Keir's head in a bucket and wash his hair? Greasy old man working men's club is hideous."
Interesting. I thought it was good hair. I think it looks kind of strong, and like you'd kind of wrap it and it would sort of, you know, clang like steel or something.
People say he doesn't believe in anything, but he is a man who believes in the power of a strong hair mousse.
I think it's an admirable quality. I'm persuaded.
If nothing else.
I can't believe, Matt, that you steered away from this wonderful phrase that I want to revise, political bottom.
Bottom.
Revive, I should say.
Yeah, you're right, it has dropped out of...
This is a sadness to me. We should revive it. Political bottom to mean kind of guts and the ability to keep your cool in a crisis, all drawing on sort of expertise and also experience. You know, yes, but people used to say about Dennis Healy, he has bottom, which was not a physical attribute. It was, you know, courage and experience and solidity.
And a sort of, you know, a sort of an independent thing. It feels like a sort of 80s Thatcherite thing to people talking about having bottom in my mind. Or maybe that's just when I was sort of aware of it in... Have you heard of this phrase, James?
I've never heard of it, but I do like it.
Let's bring it back.
Especially now when politics is so, like, you know, crisis every 5 minutes, everyone's panicking about polls, just need some big, great, hefty bloke in a big suit to sit there and say it's all fine.
Or a big, hefty woman.
Or indeed a big, hefty woman,
Big, hefty woman.
That is the thing. It's very male, isn't it, all of this, which again, I think, speaks to our kind of activistic need for the leaders that we've had in the past. So, I mean, honestly, it's so stacked against any woman, isn't it, in this battle.
Liz Truss thought the only way to get on and become leader was to literally dress up as Margaret Thatcher. That seemed like the only... The template.
And even if as a conservative woman you don't do it, as soon as you have leadership ambitions, people start, you know, projecting it onto you. People, you know, were saying Kemi Badenoch is
Sun on Sunday, Rachel Reeves was done up as the iron lefty.
Yeah, I mean, you literally can't avoid it. So we sort of need another template for women in politics, don't we, to like project onto them.
Because there's only been one particularly successful one.
Yeah, you don't want the Theresa May template.
Nothing has changed. Wearing a, you know, a brightly coloured jacket and a necklace made of aerial
if things get re- we'll know things have got really bad if in 10 years people are dressing up like Theresa May in an effort to reassure the country.
On the conversation of boldness in politics, Evan's been in touch to say we're talking rubbish. Putin is semi-bold and he's set to do very well in the election. So thank you for that, Evan. Now, still joined by James Marriott and Miranda Green. Now, James, you've written about how you spent your youth not saving for a house but flying to European cities on the cheap.
Yeah, I did. On the back of an interview with Michael O'Leary, the Ryanair CEO in the Sunday Times last weekend, who I think takes a lot of pride in being a slightly kind of hateable figure. And he was coming out with all this usual stuff about how he hates his customers and he's instructed his social media team to go and bully them. And, you know, he wants to install, you know, coin-operated loos on all his Ryanair aircraft. And I was sort of thought I should stick up for Michael O'Leary, as much as he doesn't seem to actually want anybody to like him, and say that, you know, being able to fly to Europe has been, in an age when housing is incredibly expensive, rent is really horrible. You know, I think I look back on being able to fly to Europe for like 20 quid in my early 20s as a really, you know, the one luxury that stands out from that time.
Although you do write in your column, in hindsight, those trips were not uninterruptedly pleasurable. Any 19-year-old with ambitions to visit every one of Rome's major Baroque churches will necessarily find himself in conflict with his peers. But they were your own ground. So yes. Did that really happen?
I look back with some embarrassment on my behaviour in some of those early and more enthusiastic trips to Rome. I apologise to
your
my
friends.
Your
mates wanted to go to the...
They didn't want to see quite as many Baroque churches as I thought we should be seeing.
Now, obviously, we do need to think about the environment of these things. So Justin Francis, the founder and CEO of Responsible Travel, joins us now. Justin, hi, Justin.
Hello.
Should we all be going on our cheap short-haul flights?
Well, yes. I mean, in a sense, James got a huge amount from it, clearly, as have many others. So it's a good thing. And I'm not anti-flying. I'm in a travel company. But it does come at a price. I think we all understand that. Aviation is now 8% of UK's carbon emissions in total, and it's rising because aviation's emissions are going up. and many of our other carbon emissions are going down. And it's a relatively small proportion of us that are taking most of the flights. 70% of the flights are taken by 15% of the population. So a small number are taking a lot of flights, having a hell of a time, terrific, at a very low cost to them, but quite a high cost to the environment.
Miranda, what do you think about this? Should we be curtailing our travel, or should we all be more James Marriott?
Well, I mean, I share James's enthusiasm for these wonderful cheap city breaks. I remember going to Pisa for £22 or something and having a brilliant time. James and I, we should have gone together, James. I'd have gone to those baroque churches with you, definitely.
Well, you're invited to the next holiday. I'm down to it. No one else is going to come.
Yeah. Make sure you take your step counter, though, this time.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. You know, and it cost me £155 to go to Liverpool and back yesterday by train, you know, which was nearly cancelled on the return leg. So, you know, the reliability, you know, and the opening up of the world, which James wrote about eloquently, I think are a huge deal to do with, you know, empowering and liberating the mass of the population like us, right? Because once upon a time, travel, even to Europe, was the privilege of a very, very few. Mm. So I think it's really important to sort of not roll back on that sort of age of enlightenment for the masses. But, you know, that's an interesting statistic that it's only 15% of the population taking most of the flights from the UK. You know, there has to be some way to maybe cut down on the frequent flyers. Is everything, you know, is your journey necessary, I suppose?
And what can we do, Justin? Because actually last summer we went interrailing. We caught the train from London and we went to 5 cities, I think. We did then fly back, but I suppose it was half the flights. And actually it was quite a lot of fun. So are there other things that we could do, Justin, so we can still get to these places without necessarily going on a cheap Ryanair flight?
Well, something's clearly wrong in the system, isn't there? You know, when you can fly to Italy for less than the price of a pizza, and when lower carbon rail travel costs so much more, then something is broken. And one of the things that's broken is that aviation fuel is one of the few untaxed fuels in the world. Kerosene is not taxed. It's absolutely incredible. The passenger pays a tax, air passenger duty. But if aviation fuel was taxed as petrol is, then even after APD, there's a £2 billion a year tax break, essentially, for the aviation sector. So if you wonder, why is it so cheap? The answer is because they're paying no tax. And I would like to see a fairer tax on aviation. I would like to see it ring-fenced. Then we could use some of it to make rail travel cheaper. And we could use some of it to fund R&D in decarbonizing aviation quicker. So it's not some magic business guru stuff about back and forth very quickly. It's because it's not taxed.
That's really interesting. Really, really interesting. And actually, maybe if the people who were flying around for work, they just went on Zooms, then we could have more. Nice,
yeah, I think that's the real problem. And I would bet they are making up a lot of those people who take the minority of people who take most of the flights are people on silly business trips, management consultants and so on, when they could literally just pick up the phone.
Yeah. Nick's been in touch saying, I really want to travel more to Europe on long weekends, etc. But I'm so sick of the travel delays and cancellations, I can't face it. Go on the trains, Nick. Once you get out of the British train system, it was really good. We even had, I think our train in Germany broke down for an hour and we still somehow arrived early.
That's the most German thing ever. They found another train.
They found another train and we still got there. It was incredible. Miranda Green from the Financial Times and James Marriott from the Times. And of course, you can read James in the Times every week. Just get yourself a subscription at thetimes.co.uk, and with your subscription, be able to get access to the bonus episode of Politics at the Boring Bits, which drops every weekend. Up next is the Feel Good Factor.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
The Big Thing.
Today is Victory in Europe Day.
I knew that I would.
The moment of the Queen's crowning is come.
I feel good.
Labour's coming home.
I knew that I would.
A gold medal for Jessica Ennis.
So good, so good. I got a year.
Here comes Hersey's got some people are on the pitch. They think it's all over. It is now.
Yeah, forget the economy, the tax cuts and the policy pledges. What makes a nation feel good? Good weather, good company, sporting success at the Olympics or on the football field, a coronation, a royal wedding, the collective delight at discovering a royal Photoshop gone wrong. What makes us feel good and what difference does it make to how the nation votes? If we do feel good, do we stick with the people who got us into this giddy state? Do we throw caution to the wind and go for a big change? Today we take a look at the politics of feeling good as Rishi Sunak rules out a snap election this May. Conservatives are pinning their hopes on an upbeat summer of sporting and cultural success to keep them in power. So according to The Sun this week, top Tories have apparently told the Prime Minister an early election is for the birds and 7 months is a long time in politics. Just imagine what would happen, they said, if England won the Euros. Team GB had a hatful of gold at the Olympics. The landscape could be different. But does this feel-good factor really matter? From winning a World War or World Cup to Olympic gold medals and golden jubilees, history is littered with examples of how politicians found the national mood music was no longer playing their tune. Right, first, let's go back to 1945. Winston Churchill had just defeated Hitler after the darkest hour a new dawn. And 2 months after victory over the Nazis, he predicted victory in a general election, hoping that Britain would thank him and the Conservatives for winning the war, declaring, "We are going to win. I feel it in my bones." He told the King as much too.
"For the sake of the country and of your own happiness, I call upon you to march with me under the banner of freedom towards the beacon lights of national prosperity and honour, which must ever be our guides."
But he suffered a humiliating defeat. He won the war but lost the election.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
And for the first time ever, Labour won a majority under Clement Attlee. And a decade later, in 1955, the national mood was, if anything, more upbeat. The young Queen Elizabeth's coronation, the conquering of Everest, had then been followed by the end of wartime rationing, England beat Australia in the Ashes, Roger Bannister became the first man to run the four-minute mile. This was a country going places. So Anthony Eden, who'd replaced Churchill as PM, called a snap election, capitalising on the feel-good factor, and it worked. He won a majority of his own and incredibly won almost half of all the votes cast.
We'd like to be judged on what we mean to do by the extent to which we've fulfilled what we undertook to do when this government was returned under Sir Winston 3.5 years ago.
That was Anthony Eden. To another feel-good factor then. And it is a myth that Labour's Harold Wilson won in 1966 by riding the wave of euphoria from England winning the World Cup. Not least because the election was 4 months before Jeff Hurst's hat-trick hit the back of the net.
His ball running himself back.
But 1970 is a different story. On the 14th of June 1970, England unexpectedly lost to West Germany, crashing out of the World Cup.
Germany are winning the match 3-2. And there is the final whistle. It's all over. Leicester City referee calls an end to it. And England, the world champions, are out of the 1970 World Cup.
It was all over for England. 4 days later, it was all over for Labour as Harold Wilson unexpectedly lost to Tory Ted Heath, crashing out of number 10.
The Conservatives have now gained enough seats to make it extremely likely that they will have an overall absolute majority in the House of Commons, certainly.
To all intents and purposes, you've now given up any hope of...
Well, I think the figures speak for themselves.
Incredibly, weeks earlier, Harold Wilson had asked his election strategist to consider whether the government would suffer if the England footballers were defeated on the eve of polling day. And they did. And political leaders have worried about sport ever since.
It's coming home, it's coming home, it's coming, football's coming home.
Quarter of a century later, in 1996, England hosted the Euros. On the pitch, England delighted and then dismayed, being knocked out by Germany again in the semi-finals on penalties. Off the pitch, Tory Prime Minister John Major, a cricket man really, still hoped to capitalise on the feel-good factor with the economy recovering from the recession of the early part of the decade. But it was Labour's football-mad leadership, Tony Blair and his shadow Chancellor Gordon Brown, who were ready with the counter-offensive. In fact, in the end, they ended up fighting between themselves. At the Labour Party conference in the autumn of 1996, Gordon Brown was very pleased with his football-themed rallying cry. The problem was that Tony Blair had had the same idea. Gordon Brown's speech came first, but Tony Blair was the leader and pulled rank, so he got to say it.
If you believe in what I believe, then join our team. Labour has come home to you, so come home to us. Labour's coming home.
Gordon Brown was livid, throwing his speech around the room, a foretaste of their relationship in power. It was Labour who secured the rights to host the Olympics and Paralympics in 2012. But it was the Conservative and Lib Dem coalition who were in power when it came round. And the Team GB won all those golds. But it wasn't so feel-good for George Osborne.
Medals tonight will be presented by the Right Honourable George Osborne MP, Chancellor of the Exchequer, who is accompanied by Mr Chris Brownridge.
First booze that we've heard all week at the Paralympic UK. Stadium.
Yeah, it didn't go down very well. Well, since then, of course, we've had Brexit and then a pandemic, which saw optimism and happiness plunge as stress levels rose. So what now? Is it possible for Rishi Sunak's Tories to ride, perhaps even create a sense of feel-good? Or is any optimism based on the prospect of a change at the top? Here to make us all feel good about this political history are Eleanor Goodman, former political editor of Channel 4 News. Hi, Eleanor.
Hi.
And Steve Richards, broadcaster and author of Turning Points, Crisis and Change in Modern Britain from 1945 to Truss. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Matt.
Eleanor, quite a lot of examples. Sometimes, actually, politicians found themselves in tune with the mood, other times not. Do you think there is any connection between, I don't know, sporting events, royal events and all of that, and what happens in politics?
Well, you can sometimes make a collection, but, I mean, to be boring about it, it's much more to do with the perception of a party in the long term as to whether they're competent and whether they have actually delivered economic well-being. I think it's much more about that. And there are examples, of course, of politicians doing that. If you like, there are two ways of the feel-good factor being generated. There are the kind of external factors like sporting victories or maybe even the weather and things that the government itself has no control over. And then there are, of course, budgets. And there are examples where budgets did help the most in both ways, actually. You've got Reggie Maudlin in 64 with his great giveaway budget. And he actually left a note which made Liam Burnsy seem quite polite. He left a note to his successor as Chancellor saying, sorry, old cop, to leave it in this state. but then there was the 1970 election when Roy Jenkins was blamed for not having delivered a giveaway budget for Labour and having been too fastidious and interested in his own reputation to get involved in what he described as vulgar politics. So, yes, those sort of budgets and things like that can make a difference. But I think it would take, I mean, you know, if my bet today at Cheltenham came in, I might feel momentarily better. But I don't think it's going to change the way I vote, and nor indeed many of the people at Cheltenham. I think it's highly unlikely that you can change the political climate in that way.
What do you make of this, Steve? Is it about, actually, it's about whether or not you seem in tune with the mood, and actually, you know, that 96 example is a really good one, that, you know, the economy was booming, England done well in the Euros, but ultimately it felt like New Labour, Blair and Brown were the ones who were capturing that sense of, you know, upbeat, positive optimism about the future.
Yeah, and capturing a mood, as your sequence brilliantly demonstrated, is challenging and not straightforward because there is no pattern. So 45 was very interesting because there was a obvious sense of national relief, but an ache for change. And that change was, at that point, personified by Attlee and his team, who won. In terms of sporting moments, all prime ministers dare to hope that they might benefit from it. I think Gordon Brown did when Britain won a load of gold medals towards the end of his time. Harold Wilson always used to joke, even in the mid-70s, he used to give speeches where he'd say, have you noticed England only win the World Cup under Labour governments? So even though it didn't affect 66, as you pointed out, he tried to identify with success. But that is trivial compared with the much bigger political challenge of meeting and partly defining a national mood. Thatcher did it sort of in the late 70s in her kind of reaction against the crises of that time. And as you see, Blair partly captured it. But it wasn't that. I mean, you're right, the economy was growing. But there was also an aching for change then, and the public services were pretty bad. Not as bad as they are now, but they were pretty bad. So it's a combination of things. And as Ella said, Eleanor just said, you can pull economic levers sometimes, but as the recent budget demonstrated, not always, when the mood has changed, probably beyond repair for the Tories.
I've just remembered, actually, while we've been talking, in 2015, so David Cameron was Prime Minister, there was a Cameron curse people kept talking about because the England's rugby, football and cricket teams had all crashed out of the World Cup in the previous 12 months. And he was asked about the curse of Cameron, and he said, that annoys me so much, that's nonsense. Who was Prime Minister this summer when we won the Ashes? Thank you very much. I was Prime Minister when we had the best haul of Olympic medals. And there was this sort of, there was even talk, I think, was it him or me, or even Gordon Brown, if they turned up to matches, we ended up losing. And you just said, well, you can't have it both ways. You can't stupidly take the credit for winning the Ashes and then be surprised if people say it's your fault if you then don't win. Eleanor, are there Is there any sense, I suppose, if the economy does pick up a bit and the you know, we have a nice warm summer of weather and everything, you know, we don't have Brexit chaos and we don't have pandemics and all the other grim things, might people just start to feel about a bit better about things? And it's maybe that gives them the, you know, the freedom to vote for change. I don't know, it cuts both ways.
But, well, I think that the trouble is it's more likely that they'll have a feel-bad factor, because once the government is in a rut where everything goes wrong for them, it seems to go on going wrong for them. And I was working out that if they had weeks as bad as this up until an October election, they would have had 70 more crises to deal with. And that is the danger of delaying an election in the hope that something will turn up. And if you remember it, do you remember Jim Callaghan at the 1978 Labour Party conference? We were all geared to think there was going to be an election. And he stood up and he sang this little song. I can't remember what it went, but I've got a little song. There was waiting at the church. And then he had to deal with the winter of discontent as a backdrop to the election when he went. And Gordon Brown, again, postponed things, partly because he didn't want to put his prime ministership in jeopardy, having fought so long for it. But then that was exploited as dithering. And I think that is the danger of postponing in the hope of something will turn up. And also, you know, if you just look at the economic situation, yes, inflation may come down, but there are still going to be an awful lot of people with mortgages that have to be renewed, for whom the cost of living won't change at all. And really the only thing he's got to hope and pin his hopes on is that somehow a plane will take off to Rwanda, possibly you know, piloted by Mr. Hester or financed by Mr. Hester. You just cannot imagine anything that could happen of sufficient importance. If you go back in history to 1983, Thatcher had been, actually one forgets, had this long period in the doldrums, and people, it's part of another part of the mythology of elections, that she was saved by the Falklands War, but in fact the economy had started to turn up before that.
Yeah.
But, you know, okay, yes, if we went to war, though it sometimes feels we already are at war, then perhaps that would help the government in situ, but you can't see it. The sort of thunderclouds of trouble just don't seem to break. And you know, you have hot weather and there's more thunder, there'll be droughts and things like that.
Just briefly, Steve, is there anything that you think could turn up?
No. When a course is set, it feeds on itself. By the way, I think it was in the 83 election when the phrase the feel-good factor was first used. I might be wrong about that, but it was certainly around in that election. And the reason it worked is a certain percentage of the election were better off. A lot worked. There was very high unemployment. But no, what happens is when a prime minister is in crisis and struggles to lead an unleadable party, that inevitably feeds on itself. And even when things happen that are not the fault of a prime minister perceived to be in crisis, they get the blame. So, for example, when a disc went under Gordon Brown's leadership containing people's child benefit details and God knows what else, it was nothing to do with him. But I remember reading columns saying this guy's a disaster, you know, blame. And so even things that aren't directly at the responsibility of Sunak, although I have to say some of the things that have gone on he's directly responsible for, they tend to get the blame. Perceptions are very hard to shift once they have formed in British politics over leaders and governing parties. And just one other thing, very quickly, I've been looking at the Tories in the build-up to 97 and other fin de siècle governments. And this one is much more noisily divided in the build-up to an election than any I can see in recent decades. And
I think that's true. I think, you know, there are various myths in politics, and we've discussed the one about 1966, and that was what helped Labour win the election. But the other one is this idea that the economy changes and everything changes with it. It takes a long time for it to feed through. And if the one piece of the one cliche that I think is still holds good is divided parties don't win elections.
Yeah, yeah.
And if you've got a leader who is seen as not in control or is in some way frightening, well, Rishi isn't frightening, but he's clearly not in control, and you can't control that kind of perception once it gets rooted in.
Well, yeah.
And history is littered. You know, when we talk about various parties, when Major won against the odds, it wasn't so much of any sporting event or even possibly the economy. It was that the opposition leader was seen to be not ready for government.
So the big question is, can England win the Euros and Team GB win a hat full of gold at the Olympics? Let's bring in Tom Clark, sports editor for The Times and The Sunday Times. Tom, how are you?
Very good, Matt. Thank you.
We've also got Kelly Beaver, who's a chief executive of Ipsos. Hi, Kelly.
Hi, Matt.
Right, let's work through this. Are England going to win the Euros?
It's not out of the question, Matt. Wow. Let's put it on the table. Okay. It's not out of the question. They're definitely one of the strongest teams going into it. There is big pressure on Gareth Southgate to produce in this tournament, having had a disappointing World Cup. But of course, the last Euros, we reached the final. Heartbreak against Italy on a penalty shootout. And we do have some of the best players in the world, both experienced players like Harry Kane and also brilliant young players like Jude Bellingham and Phil Foden. So it's not to be ruled out, that's for sure.
Who are our main rivals?
So Germany are the hosts. They'll definitely be a very strong team to consider. But
it would be good to beat them at home, though, wouldn't it?
It would. And listen, Scotland. Let's not rule out Scotland. They're there as well. And in Germany's group, that is the match that opens the tournament, Germany against Scotland. So the Scots could do England a favour by knocking Germany out of their own tournament. Who knows?
That'd be lovely.
That'd be remarkable, wouldn't it? France as well will always be very strong with players like Kylian Mbappe. But England will be there and thereabouts. Like, you know, your compatriots, the Times Radio equivalent in Germany and France will be saying, God, England are a good team. They've got some good players. So let's try and be positive. I think that's worth considering.
And the Olympics are in Paris.
Yep.
In the summer as well. Team GB, the prospects of a hat full of gold.
Yeah, there's always a prospect of a hat full of gold with the Olympics. We're always excited about
Thanks, ironically, actually, to the lottery funding set up by John Major.
Absolutely.
For which he got no credit.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, Until now. So there are lots of medal options. Keely Hodgkinson, Katarina Johnson-Thompson and Josh Kerr in the athletics. They've all won various different medals. Johnson Thompson, of course, won two world titles, but has always struggled in the Olympics with injury and a lack of form. So big pressure on her. This is probably her last big chance if she's going to win an Olympic gold in the heptathlon. Josh Kerr burst onto the scene in the 1500 metres in the World Championships in Budapest. He'll be hoping to be in with a run for the medals as well. And across other sports as well, just a couple to mention, Alex Yee and Beth Potter in the triathlon. Judo is a sport that we often do quite well in, the women's judo. And Tom Daly is hoping to make his fifth appearance in the Olympics. He's on a comeback in the diving as well. So there's lots of excitement. The Olympics is a fascinating one. It always mumbles along and then builds to this 2 weeks of pure joy and hope and optimism.
Loads of those names you just mentioned, listeners won't have heard of before.
Yes, exactly.
And will love them
exactly
by the summer.
Exactly. Particularly, I'd say Alex Yee as well in the triathlon. That was one of my favourite events of the last Olympics. I don't know whether you watched the relay triathlon.
No.
Oh, I can honestly. Well, the other thing against it was that it was on a Friday night, and I remember watching it in the back of a cab on the way home from my friends because I was so excited. Such was my commitment to sport.
But this is like your commitment to sport. It's like me watching.
Almost like it's my job, Matt.
Yeah, it's like me watching, you know, Question Time. No, I wouldn't catch me watching Question Time. Kelly, the big question is then, so according to Tom, there's a decent chance we could win the Euros, we could get a hat full of gold. Is there any evidence based on previous Olympics or sporting tournaments that feeds into a shift in the polls for the party in power?
Well, Tom has made me feel very hopeful, but I'm afraid we generally wouldn't expect it to make a massive difference in voting intentions. If you look back to the summer of 2012, we had the Queen's Jubilee in June. We also had the Olympics over July and August, the summer period. And the Conservatives were on average coming into that around 35%. The 3 months over the summer, they averaged around 31%. And then the 3 months after, around 32%. So not much sign of any real improvement. But similarly, we didn't see much change in ratings of being proud to be British after England's men's team got into the 2021 Euro final. Admittedly, they did lose. Or indeed after the 2022 Platinum Jubilee. So I wouldn't believe we're going to see a big difference, though it certainly sounds like it's going to be a fun period.
And also the point that Tom is making is you've got England and Scotland in the Euros.
Yeah.
And so does that affect the politics of, you know, if Scotland do very well, does that boost the SNP? I'm confused, Kelly.
So I don't think we will see massive fluctuations in the voting intention polls as a result of sporting events. I know there's a fair amount of academic evidence, both in America and the UK, that's looked at this and what kind of events have shifted them, even just temporarily. And one of the things that really has created rally around the flag effects were they're more sort of political or events where the country has felt in jeopardy, things like, you know, the US after 9/11, Thatcher after the Falklands, and around COVID, we saw a rally around the flag effect, which drove some of the voting intention polls to move temporarily. But for sporting events, while sometimes it's mooted, and a lot of people do like to assign causal impact and read quite a lot of significance into what is simply coincidence, we haven't seen it feed through into the voting intentions in that way.
It was a shame, Tom, because, you know, everything we tried to do to bring our two worlds together.
I know, I teed it up. I gave us the big
hype. Kelly, the other thing, and again, this is probably like a, there's actually no evidence for this. I just wonder whether, because those things we're talking about, COVID, the Falklands, that rally around the flag is quite a negative, you know, better the devil you know, hunker down, you know, the nation pulling together. Whereas actually, when things are good, the economy's booming, the sun's out, where everyone's, you know, celebrating success, and all of that, actually, it feels like more of an opportunity for an opposition party to create a sort of, yeah, everything's good, you can afford the, you know, the perceived risk of a change, we are the change, you know, when an opposition is capitalising on optimism, if you like, then it feels like it's more for them than the sitting government.
I think it works. You can float that both ways, Matt. You can also say, you know, they will struggle to create momentum for change when things look like they're working already.
Yeah.
Ultimately, when we see the things that people are voting on, it is the big issues of the day that they're worried about. The economy does matter. The quality of the public services really does matter at the minute as well. That's now the top concern that the British public have. It's overtaken the economy, cost of living, inflation in the last month. So I think those things, and after governing for a period of 14 years, the mood of the nation will matter, but ultimately some of those big policy issues matter too.
Well, there we are. That was Kelly Beaver, Chief Executive of Ipsos, Tom Clark, Sports Editor of The Times and The Sunday Times, confirming the last half an hour was a total waste of time looking at the feel-good factor.
So good! So good! I got you!
Let me know if you're feeling the feel-good factor. Email me, matt@times.radio, or WhatsApp 0333 00003 2353. But for now, for me, Matt Cholley, it's goodbye.